Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There are some things you want to be very careful about discussing in mixed company. Religion for one, politics for another, and more specifically, whether the big economic stimulus program has been beneficial or not. Republican leaders have gone on record vowing to roll it back. Let the election debate begin. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. And by the Wall Street Journal Weekend, offering four sections of ideas and information, available at newsstands every Saturday.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Good day to you on this Thursday, September 23rd. Glad to have you with us. What they couldn't stop in the past couple of years, Republicans are now vowing to reverse if voters give them the power and put the GOP back in control of the House of Representatives. They're pledging to slash government spending, rescind regulations, and roll back health care reforms, and to cancel the nearly $800 billion stimulus program. It was passed back in February of last year, so what would it change now to cancel it? And can we even do that? We asked our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale to check it out.
At today's Pledge to America press conference, Texas Republican Jeb Hensarling said the stimulus should be canceled because it didn't work.
The American people know that after an additional 3 million of their countrymen have lost their jobs, the only thing the stimulus has stimulated is the national debt.
Polls indicate over 60% of Americans don't think the stimulus helped create jobs. But the Congressional Budget Office found it did improve employment somewhere between 0.8 and 1.7%. A small business loan from the stimulus program helped Mark Gervich hire 5 employees for his growing photography equipment rental business in San Carlos, California. Gervich says the loan application was a bit of a pain.
Balance sheet, profit and loss, tax statements from past 3 years, personal financial reports. I think it came out to 200 pages worth of stuff in the end.
Gervich thinks the stimulus was somewhat of a success. I asked him what he didn't like, and he said the bailout of the big banks and car companies. Polls show many Americans, like Gervich, confuse the stimulus or Recovery Act with the Troubled Asset Relief Program for banks and the auto companies.
Good point. Thank you for the clarification.
Speaking of clarifications, how much recovery money is left to take back? It turns out, not much. Taxpayers are getting about a third of the $800 billion in the form of tax credits that are showing up in paychecks through the end of this year, and taking those away is not in the GOP pledge. Another third has already gone to states and can't be taken back. Set aside federal public works projects already committed to, and only about $60 billion are left to capture before they go out the door. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
First-time claims for state unemployment insurance inched up again last week. Nationwide, 15 million people are looking for work. A few million more are so discouraged they've given up. Now, that would seem to be a pretty sizable voting bloc, and a group called Working America, an affiliate of the AFL-CIO, is trying to get unemployed people to vote their pocketbooks, or their empty pocketbooks, as it were. Question is, can they get them to vote at all? Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
Veteran union leader Karen Nussbaum runs Working America, which has 3 million members nationwide. Many of them no longer have jobs or are in danger of losing their homes.
We've got 50,000 members in Ohio who we know are registered to vote, who we know are out of work, and who we're going to be talking to many times between now and the election. You know, the elections in Ohio are going to be close.
Ditto Nevada, Michigan, Oregon, and other places with high unemployment. Working America will go door to door in those states for liberal Democrats who've backed extended unemployment benefits and stimulus jobs. But getting people who don't have jobs to go out to the polls could be difficult. The Pew Research Center has found 4 in 10 Americans have experienced unemployment directly or in their families, and survey director Scott Keeter says they're significantly less likely to vote than those who've dodged unemployment.
Even though the unemployed were much more likely to be Democrats than Republicans, the fact that they're not as engaged in the political process really blunts the potential impact that they might have this fall.
Yeah, I do think it's going to be hard to motivate people.
Mary Beth Zahedi knows this firsthand. Her husband lost his civil engineering job more than a year ago. She's hosting one of Working America's political house parties tomorrow in Las Vegas.
I think that they've heard all the chatter, and they've heard promises, and they've heard it all before.
And they'll hear it at least a few more times before November from labor organizers trying to get out the vote. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The diabetes drug Avandia got a simultaneous Euro-American smackdown today. Avandia has been tied to an increased risk of heart attacks. European health authorities announced they'll ban GlaxoSmithKline's once blockbuster drug outright. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration will allow its use for patients with no other treatment options. Marketplace's Adrienne Hill reports on how this decision might affect other drug approvals.
Avandia was once the darling of the diabetes pharma industry. But when a study tied the drug to an upped risk of heart attacks, the shine faded fast. Morningstar analyst Damian Conover thinks today's news isn't as bad as it might seem, in part because recent news has been really, really bad.
A lot of the damage to this drug has already been done.
Conover says Avandia sales have already dropped 75%. He thinks they'll continue to taper off. But he thinks there's a more significant Avandia-related change in store for the pharmaceutical industry.
Companies that are developing drugs in diabetes, they're going to probably have to do bigger trials that cost more money, and it will be harder to bring new medicines to the market.
Avandia's troubles have already significantly changed the way diabetes drugs are regulated. Dr. Thomas Donner is a diabetes expert at Johns Hopkins. He says Avandia works by lowering blood sugar, but after the drug's troubles came to light, regulators decided they needed to judge similar drugs by more than just that single criterion.
The Food and Drug Administration, with pressure from a lot of sides, especially from the public, said we're going to put an extra criteria on medications that long-term studies be performed.
Donner says the new long-term studies watch for cardiovascular risks like heart attack and strokes, the main causes of death for people with type 2 diabetes. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Wall Street took a tumble on the last few steps today. The details when we do the numbers. It has been exactly 6 months since President Obama signed the health care reform bill. And so today, a bunch of new provisions of the law take effect. Insurers can no longer impose lifetime caps on benefits, nor can they deny coverage to children with pre-existing conditions. And they can't cancel your policy just because you get sick. The companies hope one change will bring thousands of healthy young adults onto their rolls. A new provision allows adult children to remain on their parents' insurance policies until they turn 26, up from 19. For most families, the change kicks in when their policies renew. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner looks into the implications.
Insurance companies have always had a hard time selling their products to the under 30 crowd.
The perception is that insurance products are bad and you can't really trust them and you don't know what the fine print is going to say.
28-year-old Aaron Smith deals with that suspicion a lot. He's the founder of Young Invincibles. It's a healthcare advocacy group for young adults.
Let me pull up our Getting Covered Facebook page here.
Smith's website lists the top five reasons that you need benefits, such as...
You could always get hit by a bus. That resonates with people to a surprising amount.
But price resonates even more. Smith says that under this new healthcare provision, a person shelling out $150 a month for his own policy will now be able to join a parent's plan for around $35. And gone are the state-level restrictions that said a child had to be in school or unmarried or live in the same state as his parents.
I myself was uninsured for 6 months after I graduated from college. That is almost the norm now, that you're uninsured when you graduate. That process is going to change.
If parents sign up their children and young adults opt to pay for benefits that many have learned to live without.
That is a change, and so it'll take some time for people's thinking to change.
Joan Alker directs the Georgetown Institute for Children and Families. She says that when policy experts try to predict how many young people will sign up for this plan next year, they come up with numbers anywhere from 500,000 to just over 2 million.
So that's a big range.
If the number of signups is in the millions, that's good for the insurance industry. They get an infusion of healthy young customers that rarely see the doctor. They're cheap to insure, so the premiums that businesses pay will rise, but only by half to 1%. If the number of signups, though, is in the low end, closer to 500,000, that means that the people who did sign up are less healthy, more in need. In that case, premiums could rise more, and employers could pass on those higher costs to workers.
They could start structuring their plans so that if you are picking up your family coverage, you have to pay more if you have three kids on your plan as opposed to two kids. And that would really focus the increased costs on the families who are using it.
Discouraging some families from signing up at all. It's like a huge balancing act where, in order to keep costs low, millions of young people or their parents need to decide to take the plunge together. Freddie Ramos lives in his mom's house in North Philadelphia. When I meet him, he's cleaning his bedroom, the walls covered with Britney Spears posters.
Well, I always feel like I need to take these posters down, but then my friend's like, no, don't take them down. I like them. I'm like...
Why? Why do you feel like you need to take them down?
As a part of growing up.
Ramos is 21 years old, and he's still looking for a job. He hates having to depend on his mom's paycheck. He's not sure he wants to sign up on his mom's health plan next year.
She'll file the paperwork, her job will see it, and they'll go, whoa, you have a 21-year-old son who needs health insurance. I really do feel like that will count against someone at their job. They'll paint that brush with, oh, here we go, we have moochers.
Is it also, Freddie, that maybe you feel a little bit of embarrassment or a little bit of, like, you should be farther along?
Oh, no, that's definitely tied in there. The whole self-doubt and all that stuff. Like, I should have my own health insurance. I should have from my own job, you know.
Ramos tells me he'll probably only sign up if he gets sick, which is, of course, exactly what the insurance companies don't want to hear. They want Ramos to see insurance as a necessity, not as a luxury that he hasn't yet grown up enough to earn. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Picture a world where banks, big banks, suddenly lose their influence over the global marketplace. No need to imagine, really. A new book lays out the case that wealthy governments around the world are now pulling the strings. And guess which country is no longer such a major player? The book says financial experts met in Washington last year to play out some financial war games of sorts. And they were dismayed to find that the U.S. came out on the losing end every time. How could this happen? Perhaps you haven't been paying attention to the rise of something called sovereign wealth funds, but Eric Weiner has. He says those funds are basically created to do the bidding of rich countries, and his new book is packed with alarming revelations. It's called The Shadow Market, How a Group of Wealthy Nations and Powerful Investors Dominate the World. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you mean when you say shadow markets?
The shadow market isn't really a physical place like Wall Street or the New York Stock Exchange. It's more of an invisible nexus where Now you have large countries that have accumulated tremendous assets that are working with private equity firms and hedge funds in order to really control the flow of capital around the world in ways that we've never seen before.
Well, it's always been about money, but how does this differ from buying influence with a country and actually buying parts of a country, if you will?
What you have is countries that have digested the lesson of the market, and that is that you gain control over things and you have a much greater opportunity to create the returns. So what you're seeing is, you know, massive land grabs going on in Africa and other developing nations because many of these rich countries have concerns about their natural resources, about their food supply. So they're basically going in and cutting deals by offering them very low interest loans or outright giving them grant money, whatever it is, and they are in effect creating a new colonial system.
China owns the food, say, in a particular part of the world. We don't?
Yeah, well, it's that China builds allies with other countries that we would like to have influence in. And it's not just China. For example, Saudi Arabia owns a farm the size of the state of Connecticut in Indonesia, and they're going to grow crops that are in demand in Saudi Arabia. This creates a natural ally between Saudi Arabia and Indonesia in ways that we can't even comprehend because we're not participating in this.
When there's this shift of economic power going from private hands to governments, what are the geopolitical consequences?
Corporate interests are actually relatively predictable. You look at where the profits lie, and then you can sort of follow the money. Then when you look at what countries are doing, they could make investments that don't make sense on a financial level, but that make tremendous sense on a geopolitical level. They could be willing to lose money on an investment in order to gain power over another country. And that's a very, very different game from the way that our capital markets were structured. What is the interests of China? What is the interests of the Persian Gulf? We don't necessarily know. And because there's no disclosure, we aren't necessarily going to know.
We've been worried about regulating our old problems. Is there any way of regulating this new issue?
It's very difficult because it's really hard to get your arms around something this size. We're talking about by 2012 or 2013, the shadow markets are going to control roughly $19 trillion. And the U.S. GDP that year is expected to be around $16 trillion. So we're talking about something the size of the U.S. government being unleashed in the capital markets. That's not something that the U.S. alone can do. We need a Western or global agreement and solution on how to do this. And that's how you tackle China's manipulation of its currency. That's how you tackle the trade issues that are arising from this. It can't just be us because we are going to lose that fight.
It's pretty mind-boggling. Eric Weiner's new book is The Shadow Market, How a Group of Wealthy Nations and Powerful Investors Secretly Dominate the World. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, when private money affects your child's education, who should be making the decisions?
Whenever large sums of money are gifted to public school districts, it's just absolutely crucial that all voices are at the table.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 76 points in a late session sell-off. That's 0.75%. The blue chips came to rest at 10,662. The NASDAQ was off 7 points, 0.3%, to close at 2327. The S&P 500 fell 9 points, 0.8%, to finish at 1124. Financials had another rough day. Wells Fargo, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Citigroup all dropped more than 2%. Bank of America lost 1.8%. Insurance companies MetLife and Principal Financial Group were both off more than 3.5%. Tiffany & Company also lost its luster, down nearly 2%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note held steady at 2.55%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Constant Contact, helping small businesses and nonprofits make sense of social media. You can learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. And by Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At allybank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care associate 24/7. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for the month of August. Mayors from across the country are gathered in the nation's capital for a two-day meeting. They'll discuss national policy issues critical to the progress of American cities. And it promises something for everyone. The Love Boat. The long-running TV show debuted on September 24, 1977. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. A ruling from a judge in New York could send shockwaves through the nation's condo market. It involves a buyer in Manhattan who put down a deposit for a condo at the height of the boom back in 2008 and then backed out the following year when prices plunged. He's been fighting to get his money back, and yesterday a federal judge ruled, yes, he can. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has more.
The case centered on a federal law from 1968 that requires full disclosure from developers. It was originally intended to protect out-of-state land buyers from getting duped into putting money down for a piece of property they'd never seen before. But the law also applies to condo buildings with more than 100 units. It requires developers to record each condo purchase with the government. But real estate attorney Jared Beck in Miami says they often don't.
In a lot of cases, the developers want to leave themselves wiggle room to sell or resell those units if they can get a better price, even if a buyer's already gone under contract with them.
In scores of similar lawsuits from buyers having second thoughts about their purchases, the developer has won. So Beck says this week's ruling from a federal judge in New York could impact cases nationwide.
We're going to see a lot of lawyers who have pending cases already in court. They're going to try to use this decision to their advantage on behalf of their clients.
The ruling could impact developers looking for construction financing as well. Michael Heller is a real estate law professor at Columbia Law School.
If the ruling stands, one consequence is it will cost more to buy condominiums, because if this is an additional risk that developers face, they have to price that risk into the cost of the final product.
He says that may mean fewer new condo buildings, but Heller says it's more likely the ruling will not stand on appeal. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
There's been a shakeup in the ranks of the country's billionaires. The founder of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, has moved ahead of Apple founder Steve Jobs on the Forbes list of richest Americans. The magazine puts Zuckerberg at number 35. And apparently he can spare some of his nearly $7 billion fortune. There's word today the 26-year-old web mogul plans to give a big check to the public schools in Newark, New Jersey. Our education correspondent Amy Scott joins us now from WYPR in Baltimore. Hey, Amy.
Hi, Bob.
What I've heard about this seems a little unusual from the get-go, starting with this announcement being made on Oprah tomorrow.
That's right. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's office confirmed that the governor and Newark Mayor Cory Booker and Mark Zuckerberg will all be on the show together tomorrow. And reports say they're going to announce that Zuckerberg is giving $100 million to the Newark public schools. And for a district with a $940 million budget, you know, that's just a huge amount of money.
The other curious thing about this gift is that there are some strings attached. What's he asking for in exchange?
Well, we don't have a lot of detail until the announcement tomorrow, but the New York Times reports that part of the deal is that Governor Christie will give some control of the schools to the mayor, Cory Booker. The Newark schools are notoriously troubled, and they've been under state control since 1995, and by many accounts, that hasn't solved their problems at all. Booker and Zuckerberg reportedly met at a conference this summer, and one thing led to another. A lot of urban school districts in cities like Chicago and New York are trying this approach of turning over the schools to the mayor, and it looks like this may be some version of that.
Well, what about all this private money flowing into public education? Is that a good thing?
Right. You know, the Gates Foundation has poured millions of dollars into school districts. The Broad Foundation is another big funder. And that money always comes with some stipulations. I talked today with Brian Hayes with the Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation, which is another group doing work with the Newark schools. He says these public-private partnerships, you know, always raise some questions.
I think, you know, whenever large sums of money are gifted to public school districts, it's just absolutely crucial that all voices are at the table, not simply political voices who have agendas, but also instructional leaders who know what's best for kids.
You know, that said, Bob, people like Hayes have been pretty euphoric today. New Jersey, of course, recently lost out on a big pot of federal money from that Race to the Top competition due to a clerical error. They lost $400 million. They've also had major state budget cuts for schools, so this was pretty welcome news.
Well, maybe this is just the cynical reporter in me, but I have to ask you about the timing of this. Coming on the same day that that unflattering movie about Mr. Zuckerberg is premiering in New York, The Social Network?
Right. He apparently doesn't come off so well in this movie. You know, charity is certainly one response to bad PR. But, you know, this guy has almost $7 billion to his name, so you could argue he doesn't really need the money. You know, I would have asked him, but he didn't answer my friend request.
I wonder why. Our education correspondent, Amy Scott, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
By the way, Amy mentioned the Gates Foundation. Full disclosure, Marketplace receives funding from that group for education reporting.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market. By Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. And by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And a final note, when you hear the phrase labor-intensive, what comes to mind? How about pouring a cup of coffee at Starbucks? Well, that's not exactly what the company blames for rising prices. What it says is it will be focusing a new round of price increases on its bigger, more labor-intensive drinks. So far, it isn't specifying which ones, though. Starbucks says it's been holding the line on rising prices for coffee beans, but it's come to the point it's got to let off some financial steam. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 76 points. That's 0.75%. The Nasdaq was off 7 points, 0.33%. And the S&P 500 lost 9 points, 0.8%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this show, a restaurant that gets its produce by having customers grow it.
These are Italian heirloom eggplants. Never seen eggplants like these until he brought them.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. We'll
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.